Hi there, I'm Carla Nappi, and this is New Books in Science, Technology, and Society. Welcome, and thanks for joining us. I just finished talking with Matthew Stanley about his really interesting and important new book, Huxley's Church and Maxwell's Demon, From Theistic Science to Naturalistic Science. And this came out in 2014 with the University of Chicago Press. Now, this is a really fascinating and interesting and I think important book if you are interested in the history of science, the history of Victorian science in Britain, the history of the relationships between science and religion, along with much else. But it's also important and useful and very much worth reading for anyone who wants to inform, contextualize, and deepen their understandings of contemporary debates. And by contemporary, I mean right now, debates over intelligent design, arguments over creationism and creation science, over the place of religious education or religious concepts in the science classroom specifically, along with many other related issues. This is really an example of a book that is very much grounded in a context and a set of cases that directly informs contemporary debates in a really, really useful way. So what Matt does is he takes us into Victorian Britain, and he introduces us to two figures, Maxwell and Huxley, who kind of epitomize and represent what we might think of as two opposing ways of negotiating science and religion in the history of science. This is respectively theistic and then naturalistic sciences, as he puts it. But what becomes really clear over the course of the book is that these two figures and these two approaches were actually not that different at all, and diverged at a very particular point in a very specific way, and not in a lot of other ways, importantly, in a history that really challenges flat-footed, conventional attempts to position science and religion as deeply and fundamentally opposing forces and opposing realms of thought and inquiry. It's really, really interesting. It's really, really fun to read as well. And it's written in such a way that is so clear, so easy to read. And by easy, I also mean very sophisticated, right? But in a way that's very approachable and also is so enjoyable that I would say that this is a book that's very, very assignable for teachers out there who are looking for readings for classroom studies of histories of science and religion. And it's assignable not just in graduate classrooms, but also in, I'd say, mid to upper level undergraduate classrooms as well. So it was really a pleasure to talk with Matt about it. And I hope you have a chance to get your hands on the book and to give it a read. Because like I said, it's a really amazing contribution. And I think it's really important to contemporary debates as well. Thanks very much for listening and enjoy. I'm here today to talk with Matthew Stanley about his really awesome new book, Huxley's Church and Maxwell's Demon. Welcome to New Books in Science, Tech, and Society, Matt. Thanks so much for being with me today and for giving us the opportunity and the excuse to talk about a book I really, really enjoyed. So welcome. And thank you.
Thanks for having me.
So Matt, could you start us off by just kind of bringing us into your professional trajectory a little bit? How did you come to work on the history of science professionally, and what brought you to the history of science and religion as they are kind of intersecting and mutually constituting as a topic of research?
Sure. So what's one of these funny situations where in retrospect, my CV makes perfect sense, right? Of course, Matt ended up working on these sorts of things, but as the trajectory actually unfolded, it was all completely random and circumstantial. So I started off in physics and engineering physics. I used to like to build lasers. So I went to college for that. And then through a strange series of events, I ended up double majoring in religious studies. But the religion was just something I was doing for fun on the side. I was still planning on being a physicist or an engineer. But I discovered after a couple of years that the humanities had corrupted my way of thinking. And in my science classes, I kept asking these questions like, but why would anyone ever put this equation in this form? Or you have to make this assumption in order for this derivation to work. Where did that assumption come from? And my science professors didn't even register these as questions. They were sort of non-questions. So it became clear to me, both after I graduated and a couple of years of working in the in physics, that the sort of questions I was interested in science weren't ones I could answer in the lab. So I started looking more broadly, and I discovered history and philosophy of science. And then I discovered quite by accident that my thinking about religion had given me all sorts of interesting historical problems I could chew on. And one of the first ones that grabbed me and eventually gave rise to my dissertation was the question of what happens when a scientist themselves is religious? Because I had been strongly conditioned with this very common idea that science and religion were opposites and they were always fighting. But then I discovered that Newton was very religious. I wonder what could that mean? Right? How did that affect his day-to-day work? So my initial area in the history of science was this particular question of how is it that religious scientists can continue to function as scientists and religious believers at the same time. So that became my dissertation and my first book, Practical Mystic, which was on Arthur Eddington, a Quaker astrophysicist of the early 20th century. And one of the things one of the arguments I made in that book was about how it was that a scientist maintained a religious identity in a time and place, sort of modern Britain, when that was considered to be very strange. That is, no one expected a scientist to be religious. And as I finished up that project, I started wondering about how it was that that expectation came to be, because I realized that, well through the 19th century, the default assumption was that a scientist was also a religious person. But then 100 years later, the default was completely the opposite. So I started wondering about how that process could have happened. And that was part of the foundation of what eventually became Huxley's Church and Maxwell's Demon, was the story of how it came to be that we were surprised by religious scientists. But the actual proximate event was something quite different. I was teaching a university at the time, and this must have been 2005 when I started on this, and there was a professor there who in the physics department who wrote a book on intelligent design. And it was a very popular book on intelligent design, and his colleagues were not very happy about this. And it so happened that he was up for tenure at this time, and he was turned down for tenure. And the department had, very straightforward bureaucratic reasons for turning him down. But the sense at the university was that he was turned down because of his religious beliefs. So this question of the relationship between religion and science really blew up right on my professional doorstep. And this was also when the last round of intelligent design courses were coming through the United States courts, specifically Dover v. Pennsylvania. And I noticed in these decisions, people kept justifying this particular wall they wanted to draw between religion and science in terms of naturalism, which was supposed to be this defining characteristic of science, which was that scientists made no recourse to religious thinking or religious ideas. And that struck me as such a strange way to define science, because until the 20th century, so few scientists would have agreed with that definition. So Huxley's Church and Maxwell's Demon came out of this particular conceptual problem for me. I wanted to figure out where this notion came from, how we came to think of science as being necessarily naturalistic, when once upon a time it was really very different.
Perfect. Thank you so much, Matt. And the introduction of the book actually really nicely takes us into this kind of deeper context and deeper justifications for why, not just why the story that you're going to tell us is going to be intrinsically interesting and important on its own terms, but also why this story is actually really important and interesting and useful for speaking back to and for informing how we think about some really important concepts and conceptual debates and political and practical and, educational debates right now. So that's one of the really, one of many, I think, really interesting and important things about the book. So the book, in order to do this, right, in order to kind of situate naturalism historically and give us a way into thinking in I think a more kind of historically grounded and open-minded way about these issues, it focuses on two figures. Each of these figures is going to represent a particular point of view in Victorian Britain. So we have, on one hand, T.H. Huxley, who's going to represent for us kind of naturalistic science. And then we have James Clerk Maxwell, who's going to represent a theistic science. But really interestingly, these are very intertwined. Like, these aren't set up at the beginning of the book, or really even for most of the book, as two opposing camps. And one of the really beautiful things about the book, right, is it's showing really the commonality between these two points of view that we might assume in, you know, retrospect must be very different. So this is one of the really great things about the book. So the first chapter really introduces these main figures of the story for us. So I'm going to kind of throw the ball back to you and ask sure. us to, or ask you to briefly introduce these guys. So James Clerk Maxwell, what do we need to know about him in terms of his biography? What's sort of most important, you think, for us to understand in order to understand the work that you're going to be doing with him later on?
So Maxwell, I should say, is still a very well-known name. So if you mention Maxwell to a physics undergraduate, they'll know exactly who you're talking about, because his work in electromagnetism and statistical mechanics, color vision, all sorts of different things, in some sets, sets the stage for almost all of modern physics. It's really a remarkable achievement. But what I find interesting is that Maxwell himself is almost completely deleted from this modern remembering of him, because if you had asked his colleagues in the Victorian period about Maxwell, they would have said, he's a deeply religious man with a terrible sense of humor. And these were the things that would have impressed anyone upon meeting him for the very first time. He was a Scottish aristocrat, impenetrable accent, a terrible writer who nonetheless loved to write and try to convey his ideas. He wrote comic poetry. And was had this very unusual religious background, particularly relevant here. He was raised in both the Anglican and the Presbyterian traditions, so he sort of had a foot both in the Church of England and the Church of Scotland, which was very unusual. But then even more, as a young man, he has an evangelical conversion experience in exactly the way you think today of evangelicals being born again. He's studying for his college exams and he collapses. He has a fever and he emerges from this a reborn man, convinced of his own sinfulness and his need of reliance on divine grace. And that evangelical perspective really sits with Maxwell for the whole rest of his life. And I think in an important sense dominates both his sense of self and his familial relationships, but also his sense of what it means to be a scientist and how he's supposed to behave in the world, relate to other people. So a lot of what we see in Maxwell in this book is this evangelical scientist.
Great. And one of the things I'll just say as one idiosyncratic reader that I really loved about the book as a whole, and it's really encapsulated in your description and introduction of Maxwell in the book here, is it's really written with a very light hand and a very humorous hand. So you take us into, as a kid, Maxwell saying, you know, asking, show me how it do.
Yes.
You know, so, like, you take us into his nicknames. He's nicknamed Daffy. Mm-hmm. You give us examples of some of these really, really bad comic poems. He's experimenting on falling cats. He's like juggling. Mm-hmm. So he's doing a whole bunch of kind of really awesome things.
It really is. He's an amazingly rich character. Several biographies have been written of him, but they tend to be this very dry scientific stuff. But he is really just an incredibly entertaining person to spend some time with.
Like, if he had a Twitter account, you can imagine that he would be tweeting really bad puns, like, all the time.
Exactly. That's right.
So then we also have Huxley, right? Huxley, who, again, I'm going to throw the ball back to you, but I'll just mention, like, again, for in the case of Huxley, we have not just lots of things that would seem obviously, like, relevant to the argument, but you take us into his work on jellyfish and all kinds of cool stuff. So Huxley, same question. What about him do we need to know to understand his role in the story?
So one of the things I like about pairing Maxwell and Huxley is we get, in some sense, Maxwell is what we think of as the stereotypical Victorian. He's deeply religious. He's uptight. He's politically conservative. He's very well read and so on. Whereas Huxley is this very different but hugely important element of the Victorian experience, too, is he's the improving underclass, right? So he's born into a relatively poor family. He has very little formal education, but he's desperate to live a life of the mind. And he doesn't see how he can do that within the existing structure of Victorian Britain, because he refuses to swear the 39 articles, which means he can't go to college. He can't go to Cambridge or Oxford. It's this very straightforward thing that he simply cannot do. And then even beyond that, he doesn't have the money he would need to even pay for, say, a private education or go to the University of London or something like this. So he has to scrape together an education just from what he can find on his own. And he ends up having to be an assistant surgeon on the HMS Rattlesnake. And he travels around the world and he tries to do his science as he's trying to figure out how to keep himself alive while thinking about these things. He literally cannot. There is no job for a professional scientist at this time. So his journey kind of mirrors Darwin's in an interesting way, right? So Darwin is a young man, gets on the Beagle, travels the world, learns these marvelous things, comes home and, you know, becomes a sage of science. And Huxley tries to do the same. Except he comes home to be massively in debt. He has no formal college degree. He's a doctor, but he's not licensed to practice. So he gets his money together by translating book reviews from German into English. He has to stay up all night to do enough work to keep himself alive. And he's profoundly frustrated by what he sees as the Church of England's stranglehold on intellectual and professional life. That he's very clear about this. He says, the reason I can't be a man of science is because the Church of England has made it impossible for me to do so.
Now, importantly, I think a point at least that emerged for me as being really important here that is, I think, important insofar as it's a corrective against how some people might think of the importance of this. Huxley is not against religion, right?
That's right.
He's against theology. Mm-hmm. And you take us into this notion of Huxley's church part mm-hmm. of the book. So can you talk a little bit about that? Because that seems really, really crucial.
Yeah, I think you're right. It is crucial, but it is it can be quite tricky to track down as well. So Huxley is one of the great controversialists of the second half of the 19th century. And he's particularly famous for dueling articles with priests and bishops and theologians of various sorts. And he had so much fun trouncing men of the cloth whenever he could. It was far and away his favorite hobby. So he would pick fights with, these are verbal and literary fights, with anyone he could on matters of religion. So he gets this reputation very quickly as this iconoclast who hates religion. But whenever he had the chance, he would always say, no, I actually love religion. And he'd even say, I love what Jesus taught. But what he said he hated was theology, by which he meant a set of religious doctrines which one would be forced to believe. And this notion of forced belief was really critical for Huxley. He wanted to make sure that everybody can believe whatever they wanted about anything they wanted. And some ideas, of course, were valuable and some ideas were less valuable. But the one thing you could not do was enforce someone's belief about anything. And he said that was the great problem of established religion, is the sole purpose of the Church of England was to force people to believe certain things. And then he would like to point out, you know, he'd twist the knife and say, and in fact, what the church is forcing you to believe is not even what Jesus taught. And then he would go back to the Bible, because Huxley was extremely well read in the Bible. He describes his own evangelical upbringing, actually. And he thought the Bible was a wonderful book, and he was more than happy to turn his knowledge of it against his theological opponents.
Great. Now, at this point in the story, Maxwell's theistic science was the standard, and Huxley was the challenger, right? So you make that that's clear right. at the end, and that's, I think, important to keep in mind, again, as a kind of corrective, I think, to some assumptions that some readers might bring to this. Yeah. Now, as we move from this into chapter two, we move into a really important part of the argument. Chapter two looks very carefully at a notion that's going to become crucial for the later arguments of the book, and this is the notion of the uniformity of nature. So can you, again, I'm just going to throw this back to you. Can you talk a little bit about this for listeners who may not be familiar with this idea? What is this idea of the uniformity of nature, and why is it so important here for both, actually, the naturalists and the theists?
Yeah. So I should say the uniformity of nature goes by a number of different labels. I just picked this particular one because I found it kind of conceptually clear. The idea of the uniformity of nature is the following claim. It's the idea that nature runs on laws, and these laws never break. They never vary. They don't change depending on where you are or when you are. It's, in some sense, a basic statement of faith in the ability to explain anything that happens in nature in terms of laws. And the uniformity descriptor there is supposed to emphasize this notion that they don't break. Okay, they change. They never change. They're the same any time you want to think about these things. And this is, in an important sense, I think, a sine qua non of modern science, right? You can't do science in the modern sense if you don't accept that there are these laws of nature and that they will be the same no matter what you do. And it's so obvious. It's such an essential element of modern science that it's sort of hard to imagine what science would be like without this idea. So what I found interesting in terms of Maxwell and Huxley and the theists and the naturalists is that these two groups both agreed completely that uniformity was necessary to do science. Everybody agrees on this. What they disagreed about was why you should think this was true about the universe. So it's not hard to imagine a universe that isn't uniform, right? Where gravity is different today and yesterday, where gravity is different in Africa and America, right? You can imagine such a situation without any difficulty. And it turns out to be very difficult to prove that the universe is uniform. It's something you can assume. It's an idea you can use, but you can never really demonstrate it. So the problem becomes, if you are a scientist and you think nature is uniform, what reasons do you have for thinking that is true? And the standard answer to that question since Newton had been that God is a lawgiver. God created the universe in a lawful way. And because he made really good decisions when he made the universe, those laws never change because he picked the right laws, right? And this is far and away the most common answer, and everyone is very happy with this answer for a long time. The problem becomes with Huxley and the scientific naturalists in the middle of the 19th century, and of course there are earlier roots of this too, if they want to make the case that science should be done without any reference to God, then they can no longer rely on that argument for the uniformity of nature. But they can't get rid of the uniformity of nature. Huh? Again, how could you do it? You know, Darwin's theory wouldn't make any sense if the laws of nature weren't uniform. So they had to figure out a way to talk about uniformity in a way that made sense in their worldview without this kind of theistic presupposition that people like Maxwell had.
So at stake, well, so you take us into, I think, in a way that's really, really interesting, some details that explain kind of what, in more detail, what Maxwell's position was, right? So how did he actually work out and work through his ideas about the laws of nature and uniformity? And one of the things, before we kind of kick it back to Huxley, one of the things that's really interesting about Maxwell's use of kind of argument in this context is his recourse to analogy. Analogy becomes really, really important to him. Because analogy and models and things become actually, I think, increasingly important as we move through the book, can you talk just a little bit about that, the importance of analogy to Maxwell?
Sure.
Why is that such a big deal here?
Yeah. So one of the peculiar things that happens in the physics of the 19th century is that people like Maxwell increasingly have to work with entities that cannot be seen or touched. Right. So if you want to make a kinetic theory of gases, you have to make certain assumptions about the existence of molecules. And you can't see a molecule, you can't touch it, you can't do a direct experiment on it. So a reluctant epistemologist might say, no, you can't use those tools at all. And in electromagnetism, it's even worse in that all of your entities that you're dealing with are all invisible, right? You can't see magnetism. Force appears to act at a distance, but at the same time, you can get some conceptual traction on what these things are. You can run experiments on it, even if you can't see it. But then the question becomes, can you say there is an electrical ether? So there's a lot of ink spilled on this problem in the middle of the 19th century of how can we bring up these, or how can we talk about these questions without becoming Descartes and making up the idea of vortices or having Ptolemy's spheres, something like that. There's this deep concern that physicists will start talking about things that are invisible, that are imaginary. So Maxwell's solution to this is this tool that he calls thinking with analogies, in which he says, if you want to talk about something that's invisible and impenetrable and kind of bizarre and otherworldly, you need to figure out how to link it to something that you can understand already. So he says, we can't really understand how magnetic field lines work, but it seems that they follow the same pattern as hydrodynamic flow, which we can observe. So let's figure out if we can make an analogy between magnetic fields and hydrostatic flow. And then the question becomes, how do you do the analogy correctly? Because there's, of course, lots of bad analogies you might do. And this is what mathematics ends up doing for Maxwell, is it's a way to construct these analogies between things you already understand and things you don't understand and maybe can't understand.
Thank you so much. Now, one of the really interesting things happening here is that you're showing us the ways that miracles and arguments over miracles become this kind of microcosm in which we can see this set or this difference in approaches between Huxley and Maxwell and their camps or their, you know, the people they're working with and speaking with. And so can you talk a little bit about that? What's the big deal with miracles and what's going on there?
Yeah, it's a good question. And to a certain degree, it's a deliberate choice on the part of Huxley to focus on these questions of miracles, because he thinks it's a place where he can really show that naturalistic science does better than than theistic science. So the problem here is that there are stories of miracles in the Christian tradition that seem to defy the laws of nature. Right? Dead things don't usually come back to life. So a strict interpretation of the uniformity of nature would say that the resurrection of Jesus could not have happened. So Huxley says, because this is the case, that miracles pose this particular problem, if you believe in miracles, then, he says, you can't do science, because the belief in miracles means you believe the laws of nature are violated, and if the laws of nature are violated, then you're no longer believing in uniformity. And if you don't think the laws of nature are uniform, then you simply cannot do science in any meaningful way. So Huxley wants to use this as kind of a thin end of the wedge. And interestingly, he doesn't want to say the miracles are false so much. He wants to say that if you believe in them, then you can't do science. All right, so it's a kind of way of redefining the scientific identity. But the theistic scientists, people like Maxwell, of course, aren't going to give up the idea that these miracles can be thought about. So this very interesting cottage industry grows up among theologians, in which you try to explain how it is that miracles could have been done through natural laws. And then there's this very particular idea that there are laws of nature that are real and uniform, but they're hidden from us. So things that look like miracles to us are actually perfectly explicable within the uniformity of nature if you knew a little more science. Right? So if I saw somebody floating through the air in a basket, I might say, that's a miracle because that's a violation of the law of gravity. But my friend who knows more about Boyle's law and gas pressure says, oh no, that's a hot air balloon that even though it looks like gravity is being violated, it's actually just this combination of other laws that you didn't know about and that God does apparent miracles through that. So that way nature gets to stay uniform, but God can still intervene.
Excellent. It's sort of like, it's actually nothing like this, but it makes me think of Battlestar Galactica and the Cylons, like hearing the music. Like it's all, you know, there's an explanation,
that's right.
Man. It's like,
that's right. They have a plan.
Wait, there's a plan. Okay. So as we move away from Battlestar Galactica momentarily, right, and we move from chapter 2 to chapter 3, we also move from miracles to the origin of the universe.
Yeah.
So, you know, small stuff like that. That's a good
right.
question
yes.
at all. So this chapter takes us further into this landscape of naturalistic and theistic sciences by looking at Victorian debates over the nature and the limits of science. So this chapter takes us into efforts to attend to and answer questions like, you know, what can science meaningfully investigate? What tools can be used to do that? And how do we know that we're not just fooling ourselves, as you kind of lay out in this chapter? So this becomes a way to understand not just Huxley's and Maxwell's positions as they epitomize naturalistic and theistic approaches to these questions, but also to understand some really important elements of Huxley's and Maxwell's thought. So you understand here Huxley's agnosticism, right, as a way of understanding his position on the limits of science. So can you talk a little bit about that, Huxley's agnosticism here, and what that has to do with his position on this issue?
Sure. So one of the ways that people often remember Huxley these days is as the coiner of this term, agnosticism, which Huxley invented, as he describes it, as a term that during debates of the Metaphysical Society, he got very frustrated about people always accusing him of being an atheist, because he would say, I'm not a theist. And they'd say, therefore, you're an atheist. And he'd say, no, it's something else. So he coins this term eventually agnostic to mean that there are things that he simply thinks human beings will never know the answer to. And one of those questions would be the existence of God. And then agnosticism, the term and the idea, has a very strange trajectory after that. But what I want to do in this particular chapter is show that Huxley's ideas about agnosticism aren't these purely theological abstract questions, but they're actually quite closely tied to really important matters of scientific practice, which is, you know, in the most simple way, of what kind of statements are acceptable for a scientist to make, right? What can scientists say and still be scientific? And Huxley, of course, has to spend a lot of his career defending, for instance, the reliability of the geological record and the ability of scientists to talk about things that happened deep in the past before human beings ever existed. And those are questions that are dangerously on the border of scientific knowledge in the 19th century. So part of what happens with agnosticism is Huxley is trying to formalize what counts as acceptable scientific knowledge and what counts as not scientific knowledge.
So something, for example, like the ideas about the origins of the universe would fall into this category that you just mentioned of things that happened before humans existed, right?
That's right. Right. Yeah. So some strange things happened in terms of conversation about the early universe in this period. One of the implications of the second law of thermodynamics is that there must have been some point in the finite past in which the current order of nature, that is, natural laws as we understand them, must have been different. And we don't need to get into the technical such here. But people like Maxwell looked at this and saw this as an immediate recognition of the biblical story of creation. And it's important to note that this is not a literalist story. So even though Maxwell is a conservative evangelical, he's well aware that the beginning of the universe is many millions or tens of millions of years in the past. And virtually all of the theistic scientists agree on this particular point. So then say, Huxley comes along and accuses the theistic scientists of talking non-scientifically by pointing to this idea of biblical creation via thermodynamics. Because he says there are some things we can know about the past, and those are things that have to do with natural laws. So we watch the laws of geology here on the surface of the Earth today, and then we extrapolate back in time, assuming that those laws don't change, and then we can figure out what the Earth looked like in the past. And he says that's great as long as laws of nature are continuous and uniform, but as soon as you get to that moment of creation, the laws of nature are no longer uniform, and therefore, Huxley accuses the theists, you're no longer doing science. And this is, of course, a powerful rhetorical move, but it's also closely linked to Huxley's idea of what counts as scientific practice. But what I find interesting is that the theists actually agree with Huxley on precisely this criterion, which they say, that's right. We can't scientifically know what's going on at the moment of creation. And in fact, they even agree on the reason for it. They say, yes, because the uniformity of nature is disrupted, we can't talk about that in scientific terms. But then they are perfectly comfortable saying, beyond that limit to scientific knowledge is God's action. And they say, that's it. And that's when we need things like scripture and divine insight and so on. Whereas Huxley wants to say, if you want to be a scientist, you can't talk about anything past that boundary. And Maxwell wants to say, of course I can. I'm just not speaking as a scientist at this point anymore.
Great. Thank you so much. And in this discussion of Maxwell's position, I won't ask you to talk too much about it so we can get to Christian socialist organizations and stuff. But I'll just mention for listeners who are particularly interested in the history of analogies and models in the history of science, there's a really interesting discussion here following on our previous conversation just a few minutes ago about analogy and the importance of analogy to Maxwell. There's a case here in which models and modeling and analogical reasoning also continues to be really important to how Maxwell is dealing with these issues that we've been talking about. But let's move to the Working Men's College. Okay, yeah. So after this discussion, we move to a chapter that explores the involvement of theists and naturalists in science education. Now, this is really important in part because this now, the importance of education is going to continue to be there for the rest of the book from here on in. And so this really gets us into a place where we can focus on an issue that's going to continue to be and even kind of increase in importance over the course of the argument. So this chapter really kind of shows us, among other things, as a way of, again, speaking to larger modern contemporary 21st century issues, that what's become a kind of truism for a lot of people today, that science teaching and religion should not be happening right in the same room, that science teaching should have no religious content. This was simply not the case in the context we're looking at in the book. And in fact, there's a history here that we have to understand in order to understand how we got to where we are today. So that history takes us into this really fascinating organization, location called the Working Men's College. This was a Christian socialist organization. Can you introduce this briefly for us? What do we need to understand about the nature of this college to understand how to place Huxley and Maxwell within it?
Sure. So there's this, the history of Victorian education is bizarre and fascinating and Byzantine, but the particular observation that in some sense motivates Huxley through this whole story, that is that poor working class people can't get a proper education. So Huxley's solution to this, we'll talk about in a moment, but this problem is observed by upper class aristocratic people as well and seem to be a problem. So there's a movement in the early Victorian period to create places where working class folks can learn all sorts of different things. And there's a lot of dispute about exactly what kind of education they should get. Because one of the concerns is that the many of these early groups, sometimes called the Mechanics Institutes, were often politically radical. That is, it was a place where the concern was that these were places where the lower classes would get together and read, you know, French revolutionary tracts. Right? So the Working Men's College was an attempt by this particular group of people called the Christian Socialists to create a kind of working class education that would teach the working classes anything they wanted to know, but in the particular context of what they saw as proper religious belief and social structure. So to a place where the wheelwrights could come and read Homer without being contaminated by radical French thought.
Awesome. Now, in the context of this organization, you take us into the experience of Maxwell and of Huxley as teachers here. So right. Maxwell's teaching science in a fundamentally theistic way, and Huxley's teaching science in a naturalistic way. So how do we understand that?
That's right. So this is, I think, such an interestingly peculiar situation. So Maxwell decides he wants to be a teacher as part of his evangelical conversion experience. So he's an aristocrat. He's independently wealthy. He doesn't need a job at any time in his life. But he decides that it's God's mission for him to teach science, that is how he's going to fulfill God's mission for him in the world. So Maxwell decides that it's his duty to teach the working classes the right way to think about science, and that's particularly in this theistic mode. So he's exactly the kind of person that the Working Men's College expects to get. He's well-educated, he's respectable, he's a reliable person to be passing on knowledge to the working classes. However, Huxley also sees himself as a champion of the working classes, and I should say justifiably so. The working classes absolutely love Huxley. They see him as one of their own, and he plays to that a great deal. So Huxley sees his mission as teaching science to the working classes as a tool that they can then use to liberate themselves from the oppression of the Church of England, for the most part. So both Maxwell and Huxley want to do the same thing, teach science to the same group of people, the working classes, in some sense for the same purpose, that is to teach the working classes how to better themselves, but their agendas are completely opposite. Maxwell wants to enrich and stabilize Christian Britain. Huxley wants to throw it all out, pull it up from the root and start again. And yet it so happens that literally the same institution is the perfect place for both of them to do this project. So they're teaching the same classes to the same people in the same sorts of places, but for completely opposite reasons.
Wonderful. Thanks, Matt. And I won't ask you to talk too much about this so that we can move on. But I'll just signal for listeners who are particularly interested in this notion. You introduced the idea here of valence values, right? Which is, I think, something that you've talked about elsewhere as a way to understand how this college functioned, or the kind of elements of this college that functioned as valence values between these two men. Do you want to maybe briefly introduce the idea of valence values?
Sure.
Is that possible?
Yeah, of course. So it's an idea that came out of my first book, Practical Mystic, in which I was trying to figure out how to talk about these two parts of one person's life. That is, I remember the book was about a religious scientist, and I really wanted to avoid this problem of trying to say his religion was just his scientific ideas or his scientific work was just his religious ideas, but to make the case that they were bonded together, even though they were still distinct practices. So the analogy I was going for is this valence electrons in chemistry, in which two atoms can be bound together by sharing an electron. And it's the same. So the idea behind valence values is that two different groups or kinds of practices can share one idea or one value and therefore find themselves linked together in otherwise surprising ways. So in this particular case, Maxwell and Huxley both think that education for working men is important, and then they end up pulled together in this particular college, bonded together, as it were.
Great. So still in Chapter 5, as we move from here, we have other cases that we're actually not going to talk too much about, but that I just want to mark for listeners. We have another case or other cases here in which we still see the sharing of perspectives among the theists and the naturalists, right? And here you're looking specifically at the question of intellectual freedom. So in this chapter, both groups are suspicious of dogma, both groups are suspicious of kind of sectarianism, and you take us into Huxley's position and Maxwell's position, again, as epitomes of these two different, but in some ways, you know, still kind of similar perspectives on the issue of intellectual freedom, on sort of what true scientific inquiry looks like, the conditions that make it possible, etc. Yeah. Now, by chapter six, though, this is where we see really strong divisions start emerging among theistic and naturalistic sciences. The fault line emerges here over a really, really interesting problem, and a problem that's still very much a hot topic among, you know, sort of ontologists and epistemologists today, and that is the problem of the mind. How ought we understand the mind as a scientific object, and how ought we understand consciousness within the larger context of natural laws? We have frog souls here. We've got, you know, trains, we got triggers, we got free will. There's all kinds of stuff happening here. So let's kind of just start broadly. Can you, or I'll start broadly in just asking you to talk a little bit about this. What is Huxley's position here? And can you take us into his idea of automatism as a way of understanding the mind?
Sure. So the issue as Huxley sees it is actually pretty straightforward. So Huxley says, look, we all accept that the physical world runs on natural laws. That's what it means to think about the uniformity of nature. But then the question is, what happens when we get to these weird corner cases of things that aren't quite like the physical world? And the primary example there is the mind, right? You can't see the mind. You can't poke it with a stick. You can't put it in a box. So should it obey the same rules as everything else? And Huxley says, of course, this is the very nature of science, that you have to try and explain everything in terms of natural laws. And then he points to Victorian physiology as examples of success for this. So he says, look, your body runs on reflexes. You're not actually controlling all the muscles in your body right now. And if you had to control every muscle that you use to walk, it would never happen. So that shows you, he says, that your mind is actually not really in charge of your body. And he has a whole series of arguments he makes about this that leads to what he ends up calling his theory of conscious automata. And he makes the case, again, starting with frogs. He has this famous essay called Has a Frog a Soul? In which he vivisects a frog and notes that it can keep working and functioning even as you remove big chunks of its nervous system. So it's clearly just running like a self-acting machine, that is, as an automaton. And then he gradually convinces you that you're not so different than the frog. So he says, in the same way this frog keeps functioning even as you cut out bits of its spine, he takes this sergeant from the Franco-Prussian War who had this terrible brain injury, who apparently could do things that appeared to be conscious action. So this guy would write letters, for instance, but he didn't care whether there was ink in his pen. So Huxley would say, aha, you see, humans are really just like the frog. This Sergeant F was the name of this particular war victim, can act as though a conscious person. He's doing things that everyone would recognize as conscious activity, even though we know it's not really conscious, right? We can see the damage to his body and to his brain that tells us. And then he says, if that's true, and it must be, then that means everything that you think of as your conscious control of your body is similarly wrong. And in the end, he has this very powerful metaphor. It says your consciousness is like the whistle on a steam engine, the whistle on a train. It's a sign that the train is functioning and it's real, right? It's not that the whistle is an illusion, but you would be completely wrong to say that the whistle was in control of the engine. And he says, your consciousness is the same way. Your consciousness is just this byproduct of the physical functioning of your brain. And we erroneously think that that consciousness has some control over the body. But in fact, that's not it at all. You are an automaton. You're just conscious of the fact that you're an automaton.
So the consequences of this for notions of free will...
Yeah. So, again, this is a longstanding problem in human thought. It is the problem of determinism, which is that if you think every effect is produced by a cause, then you can track that chain of cause and effect both backwards and forwards in time. And if that's true, then me talking right now, and of course me talking right now is the effect of certain muscles moving within my body, and those muscles are the motion of those muscles are the effect of certain causes, say electrical transmission in my nerves. And we can sort of trace back all of those physical causes way back before I even existed. So in principle, then, someone 200 years ago with a perfect knowledge of physiology could have predicted, just sitting at their desk, exactly what I'm going to be saying now. So if that's correct, and that seems to be a logical inference from applying the uniformity of nature to the mind, if that's correct, then our sense that we are in control of ourselves has to be wrong, right? I think I am controlling what I'm saying, but in fact, a smart enough person could have predicted what I said even before I existed.
Now, Maxwell's approach toward understanding free will is actually quite different here. He's also got some ways of using metaphors to argue for the possibilities of free will. And he's also one of those metaphors, including a man pulling a trigger, a pointsman shunting a train. This is also where Maxwell's demon comes in. So can you maybe talk very briefly about where Maxwell falls on this free will divide? Sort of how is he understanding this, and where do we get the demon?
Yeah. So Maxwell has a very different set of commitments from Huxley, in that Maxwell also agrees that nature has to be uniform, but he's also deeply committed to the idea of the Christian soul, and particularly the idea that human beings have souls that can make real decisions. Because if you can't make real decisions, then the whole Christian narrative of salvation is pointless. It's a false story, and Maxwell can't accept that. So but at the same time, he acknowledges all of Huxley's evidence. He says, yeah, our bodies do look a lot like machines, right? There's a lot of things that are similar between us and frogs. So Maxwell has to try to figure out some way that we can get something like efficacious free will while still maintaining that the laws of nature are real and not violated regularly. So, and again, it's so interesting that both people go to the same general area for their metaphors here. So Huxley says consciousness is like a train whistle, and Maxwell says, no, it's not a train whistle, and it's not a train. He says it can't be that the soul is the engine of the train, because we can look at the body and we know that the muscles of the body are the engine, right? And the soul can't be the fuel of the train, because then it would get burned up. So he says, well, it must be the person who determines where the train goes. So not even so much the conductor, but the person who controls the rails on the train. So at the time, it was called a pointsman or a signalman. And Maxwell said, you know, think about how gigantic a train is, right? It's enormous and has all this momentum and force. But one person who pulls a tiny little lever can make that train go to a different place. So Maxwell says this must be the metaphor for how the will works. It's not that the will can overpower the physical realities of the body in the same way that the pointsman doesn't push the train himself, but rather there must be some way in which a tiny motion can affect a very large motion down the line. So he wants to use this railway metaphor. And there are various developments in mechanical physics at the time that he thinks helps him out. This development of called singular states and instability. But really, it's this metaphorical notion that a intelligent actor paying attention to what's happening can affect physical events on a large scale. So he says the soul must be like that. And this is largely in correspondence with friends where this image appears. And then at the same time, Maxwell is working on statistical mechanics, the kinetic theory of gases, and the second law of thermodynamics. And he's writing to his friend Peter Guthrie Tate, and Tate says, what do you think about the second law? And Maxwell says, well, I'm not so sure if the second law is as important as everybody thinks, and here's why. And he says, imagine a pointsman on a railway track. And then he takes exactly the same metaphor that he uses to try and defend free will and explains how a pointsman working on a microscopic scale could actually undo the processes of the second law. So the argument is actually the same, that Maxwell says an intelligent observer who's just looking at what's happening can cause physical changes in the world around him. And I really find it fascinating how this this metaphor is sort of co-produced in religious and scientific contexts at the same time. But Maxwell is totally reasonable to deploy it in both these theological and purely technical arguments.
Right. And that's a really important take home, like among the other things happening in this chapter, from this chapter, right? His understanding of free will, this idea of the demon, this sort of use of metaphors and et cetera, and where he falls ultimately on this was importantly not simply an importation of religious dogma, as you put it, I think, here, into his philosophy. This was something that, as you just mentioned, was co-produced through different ways of thinking it. This is not just like, look, he's slapping his religion down and having that influence what's happening. That is not what's happening here. And I think that's really, really important as a corrective to how we might typically understand the interplay between science and religion as sort of these separate entities in a case like this.
Yeah. And one of the things I really like about that is we get to watch Maxwell wrestle with this problem, right? He never really solves it. He's sure that that metaphor of the pointsman is correct, but he never figures out exactly how the brain would work. But then, for that matter, neither does Huxley, right? Huxley is also arguing from his own metaphors. It's just they have competing metaphors of what they think is the right way to think about this. And these are programmatic arguments they're having. They're both trying to make the case that the mind should be investigated in a particular way, that is, with a particular kind of value system and framework in mind. So it's not something that can be resolved by an experiment or an equation. It's a question of how you think about the role of the mind in a scientific investigation.
Great. Thank you so much, Matt. Now, there's another really interesting chapter that I'm not going to ask you too much about, purely in the interest of not keeping you, you know, for another 2 hours beyond this. But this is a chapter that looks closely, this is chapter 7, at how Huxley and the naturalists won. In fact, that's the first sentence of the chapter. Huxley won, right? And you take us into the history by which, at the end of this story, or toward the end of this story, we don't get to the end until the end, right? how practitioners of science came to, as you put it here, embrace naturalism as essential to their work. And you show us the ways in which there are two kind of major aspects of Huxley's strategy that make him so successful, make him and the naturalists so successful in making naturalistic science seem obvious and unique, as you put it here. One was by gaining control of science education through a focus on elementary education, a focus on exams, by influencing textbook creation. And another was reframing concepts like uniformity. We talked about uniformity of natural laws a little bit earlier, as only naturalistic despite their theistic roots. So rehistoricizing and reinterpreting the narrative of the history of science.
Right.
And you also take us here into the context in which Huxley's work and the work of the other naturalistic scientists moved really quickly from Britain to a context of to America, basically, in part thanks to the work of John Dewey. So this is really important, and I'm not going to ask you to talk about it. I'm just going to mark that for listeners. There's listeners who want to know what happens toward the end of this story, at least insofar as Huxley is successful in propagating his ideas. Look to chapter 7. But that's not the end of the story, and that's why I'm not asking you to talk too much about that. In the conclusion, you talk about some of the ramifications of this story for how we understand, contribute to, and shape and conduct debates over intelligent design today. So can you talk a little bit about that for you? How does this inform how we might, how we ought to, how we could conduct those debates now?
Yeah. So I think one of the peculiar things that happens is that Huxley's victory is so complete in terms of reframing science as obviously naturalistic that we still use his categories today, categories like naturalism, without thinking about them as constructed categories at all. So when we nowadays in the 21st century use terms like naturalistic science, we forget that the divisions between science and religion and theology that are embedded in the idea of naturalism were created by Huxley and his cohort to solve very particular problems in a very particular social and cultural context, right? This is Victorian Britain, and he's trying to solve the problem of the established church. But now it's 21st century America, which is pluralistic in a way the Victorians could never have conceived of. We do not have an established church. Huxley was also talking at a time before there was standardized science education, and in some sense, he helps invent the very category of standardized science education. But we're still using these categories to have conversations about a very different educational system and a very different kind of religious culture here. So what Huxley would have pointed out, when Huxley says, I don't mean religion, I just mean theology, by which he really means the established church. But now, in the 21st century, when scientists talk like Huxley, that distinction is lost, because we don't have an established church, right? In America, in the United States, is a profoundly religious society, but we don't have anything like the Church of England. So when people talk like Huxley now, that distinction between religion and the established church is lost. So the verbiage just comes across as purely anti-religious. And instead of being aimed at bishops in charge of restricting education, they come across as being attacks on anyone who has religious belief of any sort. So the quite nuanced case for naturalistic science that Huxley made in the 19th century in 21st century America comes across as extremely polemical and restrictive and dogmatic in a way that it was never really intended to.
Now, you talk in this conclusion about the importance specifically of critics of intelligent design being more precise in their objections.
That's right.
So can you just talk very briefly about that?
Mm-hmm. Sure. So what we see very often in arguments over intelligent design is it'll be very straightforward. A scientist will go on CNN and say, science is naturalistic, and therefore intelligent design can't be part of science. And the way that is heard is science has to be inextricably removed from all considerations of God and the divine, and even so strong as if you're a religious person, you can't think scientifically. But what that scientist means, sort of via Huxley's term, is really a more subtle and I would say much more persuasive claim, which is that science assumes laws are uniform in nature. Intelligent design does not assume laws are uniform in nature, and therefore doesn't fit well with scientific practice. And that precise claim strikes me as inarguable, right? It is put forward by intelligent design proponents that they do not think natural laws can be fully explaining of everything around us, and is also much clearer to the point. It actually explains the philosophical and epistemological split between modern science and intelligent design, whereas if you say simply that it's not naturalistic, then you're actually pointing to the wrong barrier. Naturalism is saying intelligent design is bad because people are thinking about God while they're doing it, which is simply not true, right? Maxwell was thinking about God when he was writing his electromagnetic theory, but nobody would say we should take it out of the textbooks for that reason.
So, Matt, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me today. It's a fascinating book. It's also, I'll just say straight up, one of the most clearly written history of science books I've ever read. And it's also a lot of fun to read. So thank you. Now, there's a ton of stuff we didn't have a chance to talk about. Two entire chapters, right? Mm-hmm. Among other things. Is there anything in particular that we didn't have a chance to talk about, but that you'd like to mention for listeners?
Let's see. I don't think so. I think your gloss of the How the Naturalists One chapter is just fine by my standards. That would be really the part we didn't get into. And it's a tricky argument in that it spans a long period of time and national context. So no, I don't think I want to get into that.
But listeners should definitely read the book, right? Because we really just scratched the surface here, so hopefully they'll have time to do that. Mm-hmm. So Matt, now that this is out, and congratulations on another great book, what's next for you? What's currently inspiring you?
Well, I'm actually coming back up much closer to the present now. So one of the things that I came across with Huxley is this notion of that scientists were replacing religious thinkers, or that science as a body of knowledge would replace religion. And this is a very common trope that you hear a lot, that scientists are modern priests or modern prophets. So I want to try and get some intellectual traction on that idea. So I've picked one area in which I think you could make the case that scientists have sort of replaced a traditional religious dialogue, and that is predicting the end of the world. So this is something that scientists have always done kind of on and off over the history of modern science, but post-World War II becomes a standard mode for scientists talking to the public, is these sort of apocalyptic predictions. So I'm looking at how it is that scientists have taken over this particular kind of talk, which has traditionally been religious, and seeing if I can make some sense of what it means to say that scientists are modern prophets.
Well, and that's a beautifully symmetrical also move from the origins of the universe to the end of the world.
That's right.
Yes. So best of luck with that, Matt. And again, congratulations on a great book, and thanks so much for making time to talk today.
Thank you so much, Sarah.
You've been listening to New Books in Science, Technology, and Society. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next time.